Thanks for being with us today on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. The ball has dropped, the champagne has popped, and it's officially 2023. And the start of the new year is a time when many of us take stock of what's past and set goals for the year to come. For Americans, the most common New Year's resolutions involve taking steps to lead a healthier life. Moving more, eating better, catching another hour of sleep at night, or downing more water during the day.
Well, a person should always stay hydrated.
But what if our health goals were a little less individual and a little more collective? What would it look like to shore up the fitness not only of our physical bodies, but also of, as Fry Today might describe it,
our body politic?
So, to start the new year, we're going to look at three areas of our shared health and well-being: the health of democracy, public health in our local communities, and our national economic health. And just like with an annual checkup, we'll use this moment to assess our health and ask what resolutions we can make to ensure we can be more strong and vibrant moving forward. So let's start with democracy. Here with us is Susan Stokes, the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. Professor Stokes is director of the Chicago Center on Democracy. Sue, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Also here is writer, filmmaker, and Black Studies scholar Charlene Carruthers. Carruthers is author of Unapologetic, A Black, Queer, and Feminist Mandate for Radical Movements. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Sue, I want to begin with you. Several years ago, the Chicago Center for Democracy, which you direct, launched a project with the goal of being a global early warning system for democratic erosion. Can you help us to understand what are the key indicators that you and other scholars are using to assess the health of democracy?
One of the things we've been interested in is how useful the information and the rhetoric that politicians send out in campaigns is for citizens who want to predict or project how careful that politician will be with democracy, how protective or how erosive of democracy that person will be once in office. And we're talking particularly about very high office, people who are going to end up, if they're successful, being the president of a country or a prime minister. So one of the things we've done is collected a whole lot of speeches, campaign speeches, and we have studied them and used kind of old-fashioned just reading and an analytic techniques, as well as some more up-to-date kind of Texas data techniques, to try to figure out if a Donald Trump or a Viktor Orban in Hungary or Jair Bolsonaro, our newest guest in Florida from Brazil, if we can pay attention to what they say in campaigns and glean from what they say that, you know, hold on, this person is not going to protect the independence of the Supreme Court, we do find that the rhetoric that they use is useful for citizens who are paying attention. They do speak in especially harsh terms about what they're going to target once they are in office.
What I want to do is go back to, in this case, not a campaign speech. It was actually a farewell speech. This is January 11th, 1989. And this is President Ronald Reagan giving his farewell speech to the nation. Let's take a listen.
I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds, living in harmony and peace. A city with pre-ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. That's how I saw it and see it still. And how stands the city on this winter night?
So, Sue, I want to repeat President Reagan's question there. How stands the city on this winter night? How healthy is the U.S. democracy?
We have been through, you know, breaking news, we've been through some pretty tough times in our democracy, and we're still, I think, pinching ourselves after the Trump presidency about how fragile our democracy actually is. We have some longstanding weaknesses in our democracy, kind of some of them are sort of built in. Some of them, I think, are more correctable. We have a democracy that's not been a place that invites participation. Casting a vote has been a real struggle for many of our citizens, and that hasn't necessarily gotten any easier. Financial interests are, there's a big wide open door for them, and that makes us stand in contrast with most advanced democracies that have many more controls on campaign donations and the role of corporations and moneyed interests in their democracy. So we have some longstanding problems. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are all kinds of fragilities kind of in our democracy. We have a body politic, many millions of whom are doubtful about the integrity of our elections and have been woefully misled about how elections work and how easy it is to commit fraud on a wide basis. On the other hand, we just had a midterm election in which many voters seem to say, we care about the health of our democracy. We're going to turn our backs on candidates who mislead voters about what happened in 2020. So it's very much a mixed picture. Life support wouldn't be the right cliche, but real fragilities in our system.
Shirlene, let me come to you. You actually served as the founding national director of the Black Youth Project, and that's a social justice organization that was forged in the moment that a Florida jury found George Zimmerman not guilty of murdering Trayvon Martin. And incidentally, you and the BYP 100 founded it at the University of Chicago, so there's some connections here. I'm particularly interested in the ways that you might have different or additional indicators for thinking about how we should assess the health of American democracy.
Absolutely. I think some of the points Susan made about participation are some of the most salient to me in this particular moment. And very specifically, as they relate to how people can decide what to do with their bodies, how they can decide to build community and family, how they can decide, or even the options they have to be educated and the sorts of educational environments in which they have to learn. Access to full comprehensive reproductive health care, from the root to the fruit, from how people can understand and what sorts of information they have access to in the classroom, in their communities, and what sorts of health care they have access to, regardless of whether they want to parent or they don't want to parent. What is being called the fall of Roe, with the entrenchment, fights and struggles surrounding access to abortion care. And additionally, I'm also thinking about the steady attacks on our education system, the books, the materials, and even the activities that students have access to. If you are a student who is transgender or suspected to be transgender, having access to sports as a child, that being severely threatened or limited in places across the country. And so if we think about our access to participating in society, in civil society, in politics, and knowing that what people can what they can do with their very own bodies and with their minds being determined by a small few, it's a great indicator of where democracy is and where it isn't.
I want to take a moment to listen to another speech, this time not by Ronald Reagan. I want to go back even further to July 4th, 1852, and listen to the words of Frederick Douglass. This is the incomparable award-winning actor James Earl Jones reading Douglass's words.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy.
I love that Douglass begins this very provocative and insightful speech with a question. What to a slave is the 4th of July? And it opens up a conversation. And I think it's a question that not just people who are enslaved, people who were enslaved, can ask themselves, but everyone in the room, anyone who hears these particular words, not just then, but also now. And I think these are questions that should still be asked. And of course, not asked as though I am or we are people who are enslaved in, you know, in the 19th century or earlier in the United States or in the Americas broadly. But what to people who are living under the heel of, under the threat of fascism, particularly in our contemporary moment, it are these declarations of democracy, these so-called declarations of independence. Who is independent? Who has the ability to fully participate in what happens in the lives of not just themselves, but the people who they love and care about and they are connected to, and the people who they don't even know, but they have some sort of connection to, just through experience or by the virtue of us all living on this planet. And so I think that Douglass pointing out the hypocrisies of the United States government, the United States, U.S. culture, and even the ways that our economy functions, that's how I take this speech in so many ways, or his words in so many ways, is it remains relevant to this day. And it's not just because, that's not just seen in the ways that people suffer and the ways that people die, people have lack of access to full dignity. It's seen in the ways that people struggle against these things, that people refuse to give up. We know that there are things to struggle against because our folks continue to struggle and they continue to say, actually, this is what we want. This is the world that we imagine. This is the world that we believe that we deserve. And so it is unfortunate that Douglass's words still ring true in so many ways to this day. But just as he and his contemporaries struggled against their realities, the ways that this country impacted their lives and the lives of their loved ones, you know, we continue to do that today. And, you know, that's in many ways, not just for better or for worse, but it's a part of our responsibility.
All right, let's take a quick break right here. We're going to be right back with more of our New Year's checkup on the health of democracy. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're continuing our Takeaway 2023 version of New Year's resolutions with a discussion about health, the health of democracy. Now, Time magazine named as their person of the year for 2022, Ukrainian President Zelensky. Zelensky, Time wrote, exemplifies the spirit of the Ukrainian people. And on December 21st, he traveled to the U.S. and addressed the Congress.
Ukraine's gained this victory, and it gives us courage, which inspires the entire world. Americans gained this victory, and that's why you have succeeded in uniting the global community to protect freedom and international law. Europeans gained this victory, and that's why Europe is now stronger and more independent than ever.
Still with me is Charlene Carruthers, author of Unapologetic, a Black, Queer, and Feminist Mandate for Radical Movements, and Professor Susan Stokes, director of the Chicago Center on Democracy at the University of Chicago. Sue, I want to ask about Ukraine and the ways that, you know, we heard earlier from President Reagan. I'm wondering if Ukraine now stands as the shining city on the hill, as though sort of in this conflict around Russia, there's been kind of a discourse about the value of democracy.
I think that's absolutely right, Melissa. I those words from President Zelensky are so moving and so powerful, because the kind of struggle that the Ukrainians have been submitted to, the war that they have been that's being made against them, is a kind of version of the struggle that we've had in our country in recent years, and the struggle that many countries have had between a kind of politics of, lots of words get used, sort of neo-fascism, a kind of politics of supremacy in different contexts, a kind of anti-liberalism and anti-democratic politics in between Russia and Ukraine. That battle line is literally a battle line. But we've been fighting some of the same fights in other places, including in the United States, in many countries in Central Europe, Eastern Europe, Latin America, and I think we take heart at the bravery of the Ukrainian people, and hope that our own struggles to reassert the importance of community and embracing others who are different and building towards solutions rather than falling into the easy politics of divisions and anti-other politics. It's really a very powerful model that they're providing.
Charlene, let's go to this present moment that Sue is offering up for us. Here's President Biden speaking during the midterm elections with his assessment of American democracy.
We believe in democracy. That's who we are as Americans. I know it isn't easy. Democracy isn't perfect. It always has been. But we are all called to defend it now. Now. History and common sense tell us that liberty, opportunity, and justice thrive in a democracy, not in an autocracy.
So, Charlene, what does defense of an imperfect democracy look like?
That is actually the part of those remarks that stands out to me the most, is what are we defending? it brings me back to a question, Douglas's question. What does it mean to defend something that one has never had full access to? Particularly thinking about Black folks, And Black people, be they of various descendancies, I'm thinking about particularly Black immigrants and migrants in this contemporary moment for sure. And I'm thinking about Black folks living in rural areas and urban areas across the U.S. And what does it mean to ask someone to defend a democracy in which they can't afford everyday living, that they have to work 2-3 jobs in order to care for themselves and their loved ones? I think it is time, it's always time for people to be offensive and to assert what it is that they want, what it is that they deserve, as opposed to defending the status quo or defending a belief or an idea that they have not had access to. So I on the surface level, President Biden's rhetoric, I think, is extremely effective, just as Ronald Reagan's rhetoric was very effective. But underneath that rhetoric, I think folks have every single right to challenge that and to say, we're not going to defend the status quo because that has not fully worked for us and we deserve something better. That's not rooted in, this simple idea of division, but one that is really truly about people having access to what we all deserve.
Sue, I'm wondering, as a final takeaway, if there's something that we know, perhaps from global democracy, about the exercises that we need to be engaging in, right, in this new year, to strengthen democracy.
It's tough because the society we live in is so hard on so many of our citizens every single day, and yet, if we let it slip away, if we let our democracy slip away, we are letting slip away the ability to have the achievements, for example, that the civil rights movement achieved uh, in uh, in the in the 1960s and beyond. So it's struggling to maintain a system that allows us to struggle to make our system better. And that's something that people around the world are facing now. And as you mentioned, as you've made clear, that struggle is sort of most brought into sharp relief in Ukraine, in the border and the war between Ukraine and Russia.
Susan Stokes is director of the Chicago Center on Democracy. And writer, filmmaker, and Black Studies scholar Charlene Carruthers has joined us as well. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you so much.